We apologize for coming back a bit late. And on deck is Attorney Bruce Olson. Mr. Olson.
Afternoon. May it please the court, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. If you've read my letter to you, you will understand I'm coming at this with multiple hats on, so to speak, because I've spent 28 years practicing law as a civil trial lawyer. And at this point in my career, I'm spending time doing e-discovery and computer forensic work because I felt that there's more of a need for people who can do that out there than there are for people who can try a case anymore. So it's been an interesting career change for me, but one that's broadened my perspective on these issues. And hopefully I can share some observations with you that will be helpful. I don't know if Judge Sankovitz was looking at me when he mentioned a geek, but I guess I'm the geek of the bunch today. So if you have any questions other than dealing with your home wireless network, I'm happy to help out.
Darn, we were hoping we could ask you about those things.
it never fails. One of the things that I wanted to just mention right at the outset before I get to any specifics is the fact that e-discovery is ubiquitous, and we spend all our time thinking of big cases and big commercial cases and all this paper and terabytes of data that we have to produce. But I want you to think of a hypothetical, which is, let's assume we have a soft tissue injury as a result of a rear-ender. The passenger who's injured happens to be a running back on the University of Wisconsin football team. He is injured in the accident. He starts submitting his medical records or bills to the insurance company of the driver of the car. And 6 months down the line, after a lot of treatment from a chiropractor, determines that he has permanency and he's going to claim that he no longer has the ability to pursue his career in the NFL, which he was destined to do otherwise. The problem is 6 months or 6 weeks after the accident, it was spring break, and he was in Fort Lauderdale, and somebody took a videotape of him doing handsprings on the beach. And he thought that was so great that he posted that on his MySpace page. And not only did he post it there, he made it public so anybody could see it. Now, a good insurance adjuster, as soon as the bills start coming in, will Google that individual and find out that this is a star athlete and begin to assemble all of the information related to the football career. And periodically, they will check for MySpace activity or other social networking activity that would be readily available to them to assemble the file that they would turn over to the defense counsel. The problem you run into is 6 months down the line when the lawsuit is filed, suddenly those pictures or that video isn't on the website anymore. And now we're with a situation, why is it down? Did the attorney tell him to take it down? Did he take it down? There was a reasonable expectation of litigation. The litigation hold should have been in place. That should have been preserved. And I, as a computer forensic expert, can access his laptop, look at it, and determine when, if and when, the plaintiff accessed the internet using his internet history and cache files and of temporary files, and determined that he had taken those pictures down 3 days after the lawsuit was filed. And if I can't get it off of his laptop, I can get it off of his smartphone. So these are real things in a rear-ender where e-discovery is out there. So when we look at the concept and we worry about whether we need rules and whether we need meet and confers and mandatory meet and confers or voluntary ones, I just want to be sure we think more broadly about the implication of e-discovery. Now, in my letter, I made it clear to you that I felt that early meet and confer is an important thing. Time is an enemy of electronic data. The longer you wait, the more likely it is that information will be destroyed, either inadvertently or intentionally. And therefore, I think it's very important to everyone to address e-discovery concerns as early as possible in a lawsuit. if we don't have a situation where we have an early meet and confer, and I'm an attorney and I'm a defense attorney in Wisconsin and I'm received a summons and complaint and I think there are going to be some e-discovery battles brewing, what do I have to do? I have to send out interrogatories. And I can tell you that in order to get a full feeling of the network infrastructure, email servers, PCs that may be relevant, and a host of other things that may be relevant in terms of initial discovery that I would do, that I'd have 160 to 100 interrogatories.
Counsel, you've made your point pointedly, and that is that e-discovery can cover lots of cases, even what would be considered initially a run-of-the-mill rear-ender or something. How does your case fit into this kind of a run-of-the-mill case? Wausau Hospitals has, at the end of every month, 30 cases that it could put into and does put into litigation for unpaid payment, unpaid medical expenses, ranges anywhere from $4,000 to $50,000. Puts in every month about that many, let's say 10 of them default, 20 of them are live cases. Half of them are pro se. Yet, under a mandatory meet and confer, all of those live cases would have the requirement for meet and confer. How does your rule apply to them? I understand a football player from Madison who wants to be in the NFL, but that's not the everyday run-of-the-mill civil case that is one of the things I was reading here about, you know, these are complex technical. Well, most of the cases that are filed are not complex and technical.
That's true. Collection of cases, obviously.
That's right.
Aren't.
So how does your rule for mandatory meet and confer fit into those bread and butter cases, half of which are represented pro se?
What I would suggest we do, because this would be a unique circumstance, I'm not suggesting we go to the full meet and confer plus mandatory disclosures as is done under the federal rules. I'm limiting this to electronic discovery because that's where the issue is of greatest concern. I would suggest that we have a rule like the following. You have a rule that says within 20 days of the filing of the answer, counsel shall file the following certificate pleading, whatever you want to call it, with the court containing the answer to the following, :1, and have three questions with check marks. The parties have met, conferred, and determined e-discovery is not an issue in this case.
When you say counsel after 20 days of the filing of the answer, you mean a pro se litigant, or do you mean the plaintiff? What do you mean?
Pro se litigant would speak with the attorney. The attorney for the hospital would call up the pro se litigant, make a phone call. :1 for the phone call, :1 for filling out the form, maybe .1 for one other activity, but not a great deal of action needed if it's a circumstance where there really is nothing there. And the vast majority of those types of cases can be dealt with on a pro forma basis that way. In the other two circumstances, you would indicate that either you've met, conferred, and identified e-discovery-related issues and are working voluntarily to resolve them, or third, you've identified them, cannot resolve them, and would ask that the court schedule an immediate conference to address the issues. That, in a very practical way, would deal with that. Now, the reason I think it's so important to do this early in the process is because attorneys in their regular practice are deadline-driven. And if they have a rule that says you have to file this pleading on such and such a day, they will go through the steps to make sure they don't violate that rule. And what it does is it triggers a cascade of good practices that help you throughout the entire e-discovery process. Because knowing you would be coming up to this type of a meet and confer would cause you to meet with your client, understand the IT infrastructure, implement your litigation hold, do the kinds of things that are required under the case law that's evolved dealing with the federal rules, or determining that there isn't anything there and not having to worry about it. So I think there's some practical ways where you could deal with that. You could also obviously deal with it in terms of a local rule where the county judge, circuit judges would get together, and they would send out a notice 20 days after they get the answer saying, let us know, 1, 2, 3. The question is, we don't have any consistency among the counties in this state in terms of how they handle scheduling conferences, and I don't know whether we'd be able to get any kind of consistency otherwise. So I would feel it would be better for the statutory rules to require them to do that, because it just triggers then adherence to all of the good practices that should be followed to deal with e-discovery to help minimize the expense that clearly is there for us having to deal with it.
Thank you.
The other issue that I wanted to mention is the issue of using a special referee. While it's true a special referee could add an extra expense to a case or to parties who have to split the bill, so to speak, I can give you many examples where bringing somebody in who knows what they're doing can guide the parties and bring them to a much more equitable resolution of an e-discovery dispute than they would be able to do by themselves, or even with a judge, or even with a judge who is a fairly knowledgeable judge, because people who are in the business of electronic discovery know what the most recent and available tools are, know what the techniques are, know what the appropriate protocols are to follow in order to harvest electronic information at a minimum bother and a minimum expense to the clients. So I think that the idea of making clear that a special referee is something that would be available under the optional subpart JM that was in the petition would be a wise thing to do. And I further think that it would be appropriate to look at the special referee statute in general, because I think, at least when I read it, the tone tended to be to instruct one to avoid doing that rather than to use that, and whether one would immediately assume that because e-discovery issues were involved that it is so technical that could be an issue that would be debated. And I think it might be useful to, if you were to go down this route, to also take a look at that statute to see if it needed to be, as Judge Sankovitz indicated, brought up to the current era. So those are the comments I have. You have any questions?
No, I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
You practiced with Davis and Keelthow?
I did, yes.
Yeah, in where, in Milwaukee or?
In the Green Bay office.
In Green
Bay. But I also spent a fair amount of time in Milwaukee handling complex litigation and e-discovery related issues.
But you're now based in that Garden City of Wisconsin, Apple?
I've been there for the last 20 years, so.
What would you like the court to do today? In view of all the testimony that you've given and that you've heard, what would you like the court to do today?
I would like the court to come up with some appropriate meet and confer standard that would require early intervention, whether it's done statutorily or administratively or in some other fashion, to address the interests of varying parties. I would leave that up to you, but I think it's important that that be addressed. I think the idea of...
What I'm really getting at here is you think that we can go down to the table and try to devise that standard right here and now?
I don't know that you can do that right now today. Probably not. We don't have any proposed language out there as an alternative that would specifically address that. I've tried to address conceptually that it is something that could be done, and I don't think it would be that hard to draft.
Well, you've made suggestions here today. First of all, I read your letter, and the two issues you raise are the mandatory meet and confer. The other one is the referee, special experts,
right,
et cetera. So on the meet and confer, you've suggested several things to do.
Right.
Could be in a commentary. Could be requiring letters by the lawyers. It could be an automatic audit from the judge to go out saying, could you tell us if you have any electronic discovery issues?
Correct.
Right? Those are three. Do you have any others?
Not as it relates to that. I would agree that it would be useful, in my opinion, to have clawback language in the statute. And I do think while I think it's within the statutory authority of the courts to do the cost-shifting analysis already, putting it into the statute to align the statutes with the federal rules, I think would ultimately be a more prudent approach to take. I didn't add that in my letter, but listening to the testimony today, I thought I would add my comments in that regard.
My impression from your letter was that with this kind of modification, you think it was a fair job and
absolutely
to be included.
Absolutely.
So you would just push the envelope further.
A little bit further, correct. All right, thank you.
No, there's just a process.
I sense that the initial proponents here would like action to be taken today. Is that possible in your view?
This court, you think, can do the impossible as well as the possible? That's the question.
I have to be honest with you that I've never been involved in any rulemaking process before, so I don't know how you go from here to the next phase and whether you do it. I think certainly you've heard the reasons and have had different ideas laid out, and you can hash it out, and I'm sure you could come up with appropriate language if you felt it was appropriate. I don't know that it's necessarily something that requires you to go back to the Judicial Council. I'm not on the Judicial Council, so I don't know what their workings would be in that regard. So,
thank you, Mr. Olson, and thank you for your letter and your expertise and experience in this matter. I got a note. This is related to you, and I can't tell if it was. We got a Rule 26. Mr. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, you had a chance to speak in at length, but if you get 2 minutes, that's all you get. I'm really firm when I want to be.
That's all I need.
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I was actually sent over here, so.
Just a minute, let's kill the messenger.
I've brought this. This is Rule 26 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. I have brought this to address the issue about how do we carve out cases that really should not fall within the mandatory meet and confer requirement. And this rule addresses that. It's an example of how it can be done on the second page, which would be page 707 in the bottom. At sub B, it tells you which proceedings are exempt from the initial disclosure requirements. Under the federal rules. 26F is the meet and confer requirement, and that's found at page 715. And if you read the first subpart, it indicates that cases that are exempt from initial disclosure under Rule 26A1B, which we looked at the front end, are also exempt from the Rule 26F meet and confer requirement. And it also says, or when the court orders otherwise, which means that the court has the authority to exempt a case from the meet and confer requirements. I think it can be done. I think that there's a way to set aside some of the cases that create this concern, and this is just one example of how that problem has been handled. Was that 2 minutes?
Well, your orange light is on, so you're okay.
You did good.
You can speak another 15 seconds. Thank you. No, we appreciate it, and it's a good response to Justice Foster's question of how you can do it in a very concrete way, as well as the responses of Mr. Olson, which were also concrete responses to how you do it. That's what the court needs to do. Thank you. Mr. Lineweber. Judge Lineweber, sorry.
If I may respond in 2 minutes or less to a couple of process-oriented issues that have been addressed, and then if there is time, Judge Mankovich would deal with more of the substance. With regard to the process, Justice Prosser asked, how urgent is this? And my sense is we've been about this process for several years. Obviously, I think you can tell from all the testimony that this is an issue which the court needs to take up. My own sense is whether we finish this today or we finish this in a month or we finish this in 3 months isn't really the issue. I think that it needs to move forward. I think everyone needs to be heard. We need to consider the issues that have been raised, and the Judicial Council stands ready to serve the court in any way you would like us to. The second issue is whether or not Justice Prosser again asked Mr. Foley whether he had been in communication or how much communication he'd had with the Judicial Council, or I think this committee specifically. Our policy is we try to deal with institutions rather than take up correspondence with individuals. We invite individuals with expertise on the committee as ad hoc members. But this, just so the court is aware and appreciates that, this was very thoroughly vetted as best as we felt we could. I think almost 2 years ago, the first drafts of the proposals went out to about every organization, specialty bar, interested group that we could identify, including the state bar, with the request that they circulated among the sections. That was done, again, more recently as things came together. So we do really try to make an effort to reach out and get viewpoints from all around. Just to kind of keep it a sort of orderly process, we try to do that through contacts with other institutions and organizations. I'll conclude by saying that it seems to me that the court is being asked to strike a balance. How do you strike the right balance going in that gets us started down this road in a way that increases the efficiency, effectiveness of our proceedings without increasing the burden? If your practice is heavily weighted towards cases involving large amounts of electronically stored information, large amounts of data review, then you see the urgent need for the kinds of things that are being requested. If what you see is more likely what I think the average circuit court judge sees, you have to be careful about imposing mandatory requirements in every case because, you know, in my court, a large percentage of the people don't even have lawyers, let alone there's limited amounts of ESI involved in the case. You know, however many mandatory issues that are put in that are going to affect even the smallest cases are going to be just that many more situations in which people aren't going to comply. You know, we have rules that parenting plans have to be submitted or there's going to be some drastic consequence that's suffered if the parenting plan isn't submitted well ahead of time. You know, one more rule that the average circuit judge has to figure out how he or she's going to get around in the face of the fact that they're not going to do it. They haven't done it. They don't understand about doing it. So that's the world in which most of the litigation happening in the courts of Wisconsin is dealing with. There's certainly much more coming in. I've seen ESI, frankly, electronically stored information in pro se injunction hearings, when one side brings in the MySpace photos that they picked up, and you know, email is coming in all the time. So we're certainly trending that way, even in small cases. But we do really need to be careful to give the courts what they need to deal with the huge issues. And that's the huge issues, and the medium-sized issues, keeping in mind the volume of small issues in which there aren't even lawyers present. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Thornblatter. Justice, do you want to say something?
I'll keep my comments brief, too, and tell you three brief tales from rewriting the local rules for Milwaukee County. That's what I've lived with since 2006. January of 2006, as a matter of fact, so we're now at our fourth anniversary. And three experiences there I think are useful here. First of all, the difference between exceptions and rules. One thing that's been proposed is that we have an across-the-board rule for a meet and confer to which we make exceptions for cases where it's not needed. But if you have to make an exception 90% of the time, so the rule only applies 10% of the time, then you impose a duty on the judge to be making a decision in 90% of the cases to exempt everybody. Judges will grow tired of that very quickly. They'll grant blanket exceptions, and we'll be back where we started. If we want to create a meet and confer kind of rule, I think we have to look at getting the parties to get the ball rolling on that rather than having the judge try to review the case and figure out whether it's an exception or a rule.
The second experience is the one that the Chief Justice referred to. We had a whole set of rules for business litigation. Business litigators complained starting in 1989, about how expensive business litigation was and their separate needs, and we can move these along faster, and judges need to have rules that tell them how to run scheduling conferences. And the rules died of atrophy. They completely withered away. And I wasn't joking when I said there was only some lawyer from New Jersey who stumbled upon the rules and didn't read the headline that said business litigation rules and wanted to try to catch somebody else asleep at the switch by bringing a summary judgment motion that required a response in 2 weeks. And we'd have to spend all of our time saying, no, that doesn't apply to your case because you didn't meet and confer with the other side and they have to agree to these rules. And but you know the more important reason why the rules faded away? Trial judges already had the rules at their disposal for expediting cases that required expediting. And if the parties came to us and asked for expedited discovery, expedited briefing, expedited trials, whatever, we had the rules. We didn't need to add those rules. And when we repealed those rules a year and a half ago, not a whimper, not a cry, not an objection, not even a yawn. Nobody even knew they were gone. That poor guy in New Jersey is probably looking around saying, I know there was some rule there. What did they do with that rule? Third tale, and this is what Justice Bradley just referred to. These rules are rules that self-represented litigants have to live with. And this is the thing that April and Bill and I were talking about over lunch. Ed joined us just after we came up with this thought. So you have a meet and confer rule, and a lawyer sits down on one side of the table with a self-represented litigant and says, are you going to do any electronic discovery? The self-represented litigant says, no, I have no idea what that is. And the lawyer says, fine. And you go to the judge and say, there's no electronic discovery. Then that person gets a lawyer who says, what do you mean we're not doing electronic discovery? Of course we're doing it. There's all kinds of emails with all of the smoking guns in them. And the other lawyer says, sorry, didn't bring it up before the scheduling conference. You're barred. Or you can imagine it going down this way. They have the conversation, and the self-represented litigant says, I don't trust you. You're a lawyer. I'm not going to make an agreement. And so then the party represented by the lawyer goes to the court and says, you should hold them in default because they wouldn't, in good faith, attend a meet and confer conference. That's not to say that this is a bad idea. I guess this is how I'll conclude. That's a good idea for the Judicial Council to continue studying. I think if we look at this incrementally, we've got four or five good proposals here that everybody agrees with. Why don't we get those done today? We have the whole Rule 502 inadvertent disclosure thing on our agenda over there. We have the spoliation issue on the agenda there. If this is important for us to continue looking at, we can continue looking at that and come back with a proposal that may address some of these issues and maybe even come back with a way that we can triage, to use Justice Bradley's term, these cases and try to get the benefits at least for the business cases. Any other questions that can answer anything? Thank you.
I just, again, want to express my thanks to all of you who have worked on this, all of you who have reviewed it and appeared. Yeah, this is a difficult area, and the interesting thing about it is how much agreement there is as well as disagreement. So, again, the court's thanks to all of you. I'm sorry, did you want to say something? It'll be anticlimactic.
This is a public hearing, and the proponents of this petition are exceptionally eloquent, well-informed, and have put in a great deal of effort. But there have been some not necessarily dissenting voices, but some concerns that other issues should be addressed. Really, I'm taking away from your closing statements that the court is being asked simply to rubber stamp what it is that you proposed. And that's a little bit troublesome. Why would we have a public hearing if we were just going to rubber stamp what you proposed?
I'm not asking for rubber stamp of anything. Frankly, you know, and I have to be honest about this, I'm the chair of the Criminal Benchbook Committee, which is meeting today. And I told him I'd be here for an hour and a half. A rubber stamp. Here's a better way to look at it. We want to keep Wisconsin ahead of the curve. There are proposals on the table to replot the curve, of chemical discovery, chemically stored information, and electronically stored information, to replot the curve of mandatory discovery or disclosure across the board. Those are things that I think can await another day. There's some proposals here that are pretty sound, and it would help keep us ahead of the curve just to get that business done today. And if there's tweaking and tinkering and other work to be done with that, we're certainly happy to do it. And if the court is unhappy with what's before it today, then send that back too.
You're not asking for verbatim necessarily. You'd like it, though.
Well, in fact, the court proposed that for three of those rule changes that we proposed, that instead of using updated Wisconsin language, we dispense with Wisconsin's rule altogether and adopt a federal rule. We're with you on that. That was the court's suggestion. We'll rubber stamp that.
Okay. Good. You got a stamp? Okay.
Okay, well, then we got to talk about the Judicial Council's budget. They need more budget for stamps.
Any other comments?
Oh, boy.
All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to appear and be heard on 0901 in the matter of the amendment of 802 through 80507 as noticed? Hearing none, this hearing is closed. The court will recess for a few moments, and it'll be just a few, meet in open administrative conference. Okay.